Good morning and welcome to A Public Affair on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Today we'll be looking at media literacy, fact-checking, and changing news consumption habits and how to avoid or even pull people out of internet rabbit holes. My guests today are Dr. Ellis Jones and Claire Woodcock. Dr. Ellis Jones received his doctoral degree in sociology from the University of Colorado Boulder. He's now an associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. Welcome to you. Yeah. And we also have in the studio Claire Woodcock. She's a regular contributor to Vice's Motherboard and a grad student at CU Boulder in media studies. I'm so pleased to have you both in the studio with me this morning.
Thanks for having us.
So we are taking calls this morning, and the topic is, of course, as we mentioned, disinformation, misinformation, media literacy. Do you have one of those relatives who send you kind of iffy things that they've read on Facebook? Do you get those YouTube links and your urge to sit through a 2.5 hour, how do I even say it? You know the ones.
I think everybody has family members just like that, where you're just not sure which rabbit holes they've fallen into or how to get them out and how to bridge that gap between, you know, this information, misinformation, and even confront your own biases in the meantime.
Exactly. And this is a call-in show today, so I want to give out the number first and foremost. The number to call is 303-442-4242. That is the Boulder studio number. Again, that's 303-442-4242. But before we go on our own journey down this rabbit hole or tangent or whatever we call it, let's give listeners a bit more background about what it is that both of you do. Ellis, you have been involved in the Better World Handbook and corporate accountability efforts. Tell us a bit about that.
So I was actually a grad student at CU for a number of years, and I roped a couple of other grad students into a project called the Better World Handbook. It was a way of avoiding my dissertation, to be honest. And my professors thought it was a terrible idea at the time, but we couldn't help ourselves. We really wanted to democratize activism by taking all of the social and environmental problems that were out there and try to boil them down into individual actions that people could take to make the world a little bit better. And so we came up with this Better World Shopping Guide. We got it published in 2001. And out of that shopping guide, which we published a second edition from, 95% of all the feedback we got were from people who were interested in 4 pages of a 400-page book. And those 4 pages were from a shopping section in which we had sort of just cobbled together these rankings for corporations. And people were fascinated by it. And so the next project I embarked on was the Better World Shopping Guide, also the Better World Shopper. It was an internet project as well as a research project that turned into a book. It's now in its 7th edition. It just released. And so what I've done in this project is try to wrap my arms around all of the publicly available information that exists out there on corporate responsibility on along every issue you can imagine. So community involvement and animal protection issues and the environment and human rights and social justice, just everything, and pull all of that into a database to create a kind of A to F ranking system of companies and figure out, you know, who are the good guys and bad guys so that people can spend their dollars in a way that's effective, a way to sort of engage in a kind of not dissimilar ways in which we engage in sort of political democracy, but on a daily basis with our dollars so that we can align those dollars in a way to help us create a kind of more economic democracy. And it's out of that project that led me ultimately to taking the same design and lens and research approach to things like media.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, you're talking about dollars and ethical consumption, but also we now live in an age of where your attention is part of the economy.
Exactly.
So let's loop it back to this. Claire, tell me about your work in media literacy and how that ties into some of the coverage that you've been doing for Motherboard.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. I got my start in public radio up in Aspen, and I was an arts and culture reporter, and you wouldn't necessarily think that arts would get so divisive sometimes, but I remember being, you know, like 24 years old and getting these just like comments that are just like fake news. And I'm like, about art? Really? And something, and that was around the time when Donald Trump was elected president, and we've seen the world kind of shift the way that it has the last couple of years. And so something in with that experience of just being called fake news, it really made me think, am I fake? Am I real? And have these like existential crises, sort of like, what is news? What is truth? What is not truth? So I think that my reporting has really been really inspired by those questions that I've been trying to answer for all of these years. So, I mean, I don't necessarily write about like media literacy specifically when I'm writing for places like Vice, but I try to think about it as like, am I getting as close to the truth as possible? And like, how close can you get? Because you can drive yourself pretty wild trying to like find that like balance. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. It's something that we struggle with here as well, because, you know, sometimes we'll get listener comments about why aren't we, you know, covering something that you just cannot be based in provable fact. So that's a kind of a touchstone for me. If you cannot prove something, then maybe, you know, it doesn't really deserve a degree of credibility that some would like to put onto it.
Sure.
And it's very much comes back to reinforcing biases, right? So again, I want to invite the callers to participate in this discussion. Do you have a relative that you've somehow lost to online conspiracy theories, to beliefs that cannot be backed up with provable fact? And do you struggle with connecting with them or having civil discussions with them? What went wrong? How did it go wrong? And, you know, we're here to tackle these conversations with you. The number is 303-442-4242. And this is something that I've been, you know, I think we saw it a lot during the pandemic, of course, because there's a lot of fear. So when you have fear in the mix, a lot of times it facilitates. It kind of becomes a compost for these visceral reactions that aren't necessarily rational or fact-based. And when people feel that their lives are on the line, it triggers a certain reaction, right? So I have been having these discussions and seeking out experts as well to talk about how to discern fact from fiction, even though it's one of those things that should be obvious. It's not always that cut and dry. And let's start with the difference between disinformation and misinformation. And I have a quick clip from Dr. Claire Wardle. She has a PhD in communications, a master's in political science, and is the co-founder and director of First Draft, which is a nonprofit that researches and addresses mis and disinformation. So I asked her to define the difference between disinformation and misinformation.
So disinformation is when people are deliberately creating false or misleading information with the whole purpose of creating harm. So this might be, for example, a Russian troll trying to derail an election in the US. That is very different to misinformation, which is when my mom sees something on Facebook, doesn't realize it's false. She's trying to be helpful and she reshares it. That's still false and misleading information, but she didn't realize that. She certainly didn't mean any harm.
Okay, so that's the difference between disinformation and misinformation. It's basically an intent to cause harm. Now, who is most likely to share misinformation? Again, this is Dr. Claire Wardle.
People who are frightened. And right now, the world is a pretty frightening place. So as humans, we have very powerful brains. But unfortunately, when we are frightened or scared or angry, it means that we're less likely to kind of use the critical functions in our brains. So those who are trying to manipulate us are more likely to create content deliberately designed to make us scared. And so in the last 10 to 15 years, many people have got increased economic insecurity. We've got a pandemic. The world looks very different. And so in that environment, people want kind of a foundation. They want simple explanations. Well, you know, what's a simple explanation? A conspiracy theory. So people are vulnerable. They feel less connected to their communities. There are more people who are, you know, we know this. Fewer people are connecting to their community, living alone. And in those environments, these online conspiracy spaces provide that explanation. They provide that community in a world that feels increasingly out of control and scary.
Again, that was Dr. Claire Wardle. She has a PhD in communications, a master's in political science, and is the co-founder and director of First Draft. I have two guests with me in the studio. Dr. Ellis Jones is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, and Claire Woodcock, who is a regular contributor to Vice's Motherboard and is a grad student in media studies at CU Boulder. We are taking your calls today. Again, the number is 303-442-4242, but I want to ask you first, Claire, what are they teaching in school when it comes to media studies and media literacy?
Oh, goodness, that's quite the question. I would definitely say to be skeptical and that you really need to have these more like robust critical thinking skills. I mean, I think that's always been important, but I think now more than ever we're hearing you need to be able to you have to have this like these tools in your toolbox to be able to identify like what is true and what's not true. But it's really just like be skeptical, be more skeptical. Do not just take things at face value.
What about you, Ellis? You're a professor. How do you teach media literacy?
Well, so I do teach a course on the sociology of television and media, and we start with 2 weeks on critical thinking, just not even dealing with the media specifically, just nailing down, you know, understanding what dichotomous thinking is versus absolute relativism versus, you know, forms of multiplicity and commitment. There's so much good information out there, but it's often not taught. And then we use that and start applying it week to week to news stories and understanding how to deconstruct those stories, understanding what the source of the story is, where it comes from. And then I also have my students go through and submit articles from news outlets that are highly rated for their integrity. I usually say in my own rating system from A to F, I say a B or better. You can bring in those news stories. And this is a way of practicing sort of good news media hygiene for them to get used to the stories. And they can pick sources from the left or the right or the center, whatever they would like. But I want them to start with those that have, you know, documented integrity and fact-based news. And then after a while, we start to look into those news sources, which, you know, are not getting such great grades, that actually have a kind of reputation for, you know, a kind of combination of opinion and entertainment and fear-mongering and all of that, so that we can then say, okay, how is this different from what we have been talking about earlier? And what are the ways in which you can identify it?
I want to take your class.
Well, so you're talking about a rating system, and that comes back to something else that you're also working on. You have a type of integrity report card for media outlets. Who's doing the job right and who is failing?
That's a great question. So this actually came out of this class that I was teaching with students from their own questions. We started to try to investigate, you know, how can we tell as individuals which sources that we can trust and which we can't trust? And how do we document, you know, which sources are actually kind of left or center or right? Like, what is their political bias on the one hand? So if you think of a spectrum left to right, sort of on a horizontal axis, and then from top to bottom, we have sort of fact-based versus opinion-based. And so that measures the kind of overall integrity. So out of this project, we looked at as many sources as we could find that were, had significant research behind them. And we put all of the data together and started to create this system that could kind of rate in very simple terms from A to F, you know, what these companies or what these news media outlets were doing, how their integrity is, and also, you know, where they are on the political spectrum. And I think, you know, what was interesting in this process and part of what we talk about in class is that we often frame these questions as a question of, oh, where do you get your news? Are you is it mainstream? Are you a lefty or progressive? Are you conservative or on the right? But I think there is a deeper bias that most people don't recognize or talk about. Some people call it commercial bias. Some people call it entertainment bias. But there is a third bias that most people don't realize that I think in some ways fundamentally got us into this problem that has nothing to do with politics, has nothing to do with left versus right or conservative versus liberal, but rather has to do with the way in which we've organized our systems of media to be mostly for profit. And even when they're not for profit, that they have to serve a particular audience, and those audiences respond more powerfully to things that are, for example, more emotional, more entertaining, you know, more accessible, shorter sound bites, etc. That kind of bias is not particularly left or right, but has led us down to this giant rabbit hole, which has then created this new system of media where we're all kind of feeling lost and trying to find our way.
And, you know, I would say that there are points at which perhaps, and this is where it gets tough to nail down. What exactly do you mean by left and right? Like, what are your criteria for defining what's on the left and what's on the right?
That's a great question. So this is how I like to answer all of my questions in my research. And that is, I try my best not to define it myself. What I try to do is I try to take the experts and how they define it. So, for example, in this case, there's a handful of projects out there that are really great projects, the top of which might be AdFontes Media Project, which has this wonderful system of rating and using researchers to rate bias from left to center to right. And they have their own set of criteria. And then I take that and I add it to Media Bias Fact Check, which is another older project that has a series of researchers that also do left and center and right. And then I add that to something called All Sides. And All Sides, all they do is spend all of their time trying to figure out what left, center, and right is. They actually don't rate based on, you know, fact-based or opinion-based or media integrity. They just rate based on how political that particular media bias is. And so instead of trusting myself or trusting any one project, what I do is synthesize all of the major projects out there to get a sense of what is left and center and right.
Claire, I see you kind of nodding along. Did you have something you wanted to add to that?
No, I think it's so interesting that you brought up the media bias charts, because I'm a big fan of the folks at AdFontes as well. I know them.
Okay, stop. First, explain to the listeners, what is AdFontes?
Oh, they're based in Colorado, and they've created this media bias chart that they update pretty regularly, and they have different versions for like print and digital and TV and podcasts. And they basically they'll rate things on like an XY axis based on, you know, like bias and reliability. And they will look at things like how neutral something is, to how extreme left it is, to how extreme right it is. And I think that it's a really interesting project. And I think it's something that's really important to be out there. And it's a useful tool. I use it too. I mean, there has been like folks like over at like Pointer who have talked about like, hey, maybe these media bias charts, like who is the audience for this? Who are they serving? Like the people who are really like hyper focused on like not spreading misinformation, like they're the people who are going to like most likely to engage with this. But are we reaching the people that really should be engaging with it?
Yeah, excellent point. And I would say, I mean, we have, since the phones aren't ringing, we're gonna bring one of our interns in here, Christian Garibay. Hello, welcome. Jump on that mic over there. I have a question to ask you. Gen Z, you know, over the course of my lifetime, I'm a Gen Xer. You know, I can remember when the media was just like in newspapers. It was physical things that you could hold in your hands or watch on the television. And it seemed so frustrating to be able to try to get through, try to break through these media barriers. And when I was in my 20s, there was a little thing called indie media that just kind of revolutionized access to the media by people who were on the ground. And that eventually came into what was later known as like blogging, right? So that opened it up a bit more. And now your generation has come up always with the internet. Social media has always been right at your fingertips. How do you parse through things to know what's real and what isn't?
I mean, again, like you said, we have all this media at our fingertips. So even sometimes I find it difficult to navigate through, you know, all these sources, all these resources, I guess. And so the way I try to solely focus on it is just to really find what works for me, I guess. What sources I think that actually are pretty reliable or I guess have the information I'm looking for. And I especially come from people that I think really know what they're talking about, or at least are trying to spread the best information possible, or at least the most reliable. So, I mean, on TikTok, I know I follow this one guy who doesn't work for any, you know, news media outlet, just does it in the middle of his living room, but shares basically everything that's going on in the world every day just to keep us updated. I forget what it's called, but I know it's stuff like that. It's genuine, reliable information like that I usually try to look for. I know that's at least what I think works for me.
Okay, so let's go back to, I want to get your perspective as a professor and yours as a media studies grad student. I think that something that maybe a lot of people don't know, but should know, and we of course know, being behind microphones, is that there are legal constraints on broadcasters, people who are licensed by the FCC, as to what we can put out there in the sense of veracity. You know, we can be liable for slander, defamation, and social media is not subject to those same rules. You can get out on social media and say anything you want. And when that becomes dangerous is when it's information that is, of course, you know, as we mentioned before, shared with malice. So can you explain, as a professor, what exactly are the rules that are different for professional broadcasters and for people who are just broadcasting on TikTok from the middle of their living room?
It's a great question. So I think a couple of things. You know, first a brief answer, and then I'm going to push back a little bit. So when you have a YouTube channel or a TikTok, you know, you're really only regulated by as much as that particular company wants to regulate you. There's really no, as far as I know, there's no sort of federal regulation about exactly how you have to be treated. So the company decides, and each company is different. So that's why Twitter sometimes bans people, but they still have a YouTube channel, etc. So on the one hand, this opens up this kind of like Wild West of media. In this sort of micromedia environment that hadn't existed before. Having said that, what I don't want to lose sight of is the fact that the macromedia, the broadcast media, has also had its rules slowly watered down to the point at which, you know, some of the kind of least reliable or worst rated media outlets are actually very large media outlets. They broadcast on television, they broadcast on radio, they broadcast the ways that we often get our media at these macro levels. And yet they seem to be able to get away with, you know, all kinds of kind of crazy assertions and not be held accountable for that. And I think this is where sort of my research into corporations and my research into news media comes together. Because for me, the problem with consumers trying to hold corporations accountable in general is that they are so likely to greenwash, which is a term I'm not sure everybody's familiar with, but essentially fudge about what they are doing, right? Pretend that they are making the world better when in fact they're not at all. They're doing the opposite. But because the regulations around that are so loose, the veracity regulations, the fraud regulations, et cetera, you know, it has become standardized. So most corporations are greenwashing now just to stay in the race because they know their competitors are greenwashing. And so we have this similar environment in macro media, not even talking about micro like TikTok and YouTube and Twitter, the macro media world, in which most of these large broadcasters are just never held accountable, so that when they are able to broadcast, you know, the rules are just not in place. So I think in some ways our eye is not on the correct ball. If we just look at the Wild West of micromedia, which I know is a quite different environment, because the real issues in some ways are still the problem of lack of regulation in macro media, which is why somebody can turn on the TV, for example, and watch Fox News or, you know, the One American News Network or whatever. And they can, you know, for the most part, say almost anything they want and not be held accountable. And that's why, you know, somebody can legitimately the same, because they all came through the same macro media type networks, and yet be completely different standards of reliability or integrity or fact-based presentation. And so if we don't take care of that sort of macro problem, I don't think we can just turn and start to blame micro outlets for their lack of regulation.
Yeah, fair enough. I think that also, can you break down for listeners? And again, actually, we're top of the hour, so want to remind everybody, you are listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. My guests in the studio today, Dr. Ellis Jones and Claire Woodcock. I also have Christian Garibay in here because he's not answering phones. If you want to give us a call, it's 303-442-4242. But on the mic right now, he's giving us his perspective as to how Gen Z consumes media, which is a valuable perspective to have. And I think that what you just mentioned, Ellis, was about holding macro media accountable, and you brought up Fox News, which is most often at the top of everybody's list as a big offender. How are they legally able to package deception as truth?
It's a great question. Again, I think it reveals this larger systemic problem of a lack of regulation. But here's something that I think is really interesting that most people don't think about. When people think of Fox News, they just think, oh, well, that's the conservative news outlet. And, you know, and they started, you know, propagating this particular model, and it went sort of off script from the other major news outlets. And it's because, you know, they're very hyper-conservative. And I would like to propose a different read of that evolution in this particular situation. You know, I grew up in the time when we had the three major news networks, ABC, NBC, and CBS, and then emerged this sort of fourth network, Fox, the Fox Channel. And before, you know, when the Fox Channel was originally created, it didn't have a news section. It was just the Fox Channel. And what they did, which I think was brilliant at the time and turned out to be later, instead of broadcasting news at 6 o'clock, which is when all of the news came on, right, and each of these outlets was competing head to head to be the, you know, the most prestigious news outlet, the one that people trusted most, the people wanted to watch most, they broadcast The Simpsons. And this was something completely different because everybody thought, well, news comes on at 6. But now they had an option. And this goes back to Neil Postman's work in the 80s. He's still not quite as well known as Marshall McLuhan, but he's a media analyst. And he often said the fundamental problem with news is that news cannot compete with fantasy. Reality can never compete with fantasy. Fantasy will always win. It has so much more leeway than reality, which can be very boring and plain and so forth. You have to stick to the facts, obviously. So here comes Fox, and it has this model of entertainment. And it decides, well, you know what? This is incredibly lucrative, and it works really well. All these viewers say, you know what? The news is depressing. It's a little boring. You know, once I watch a little bit of it, I just want to move over and just forget. I've had a long work day, so I'm going to watch The Simpsons. And so out of this entertainment model, Fox creates this empire where they're amazing at entertainment. And Fox has had so many incredible, you know, entertainment-based shows. And then this news division emerges. But the model is different. The model is not conservative right off the bat. The model is, let's make the news entertaining. And what that means is, to make something more entertaining, you just add a little bit more fantasy to it. You kind of spice it up, right? More emotional. you know, more resonant. You sort of like take the things and you blow them up just a little bit. It's like fudging a story when you're telling somebody a good story. You sort of fudge the details and you make it a little bigger and more exciting. And then they love to hear the story, right, rather than keeping it boring. And so here comes Fox. And as they create this empire based on this model of entertainment first, right, suddenly this news division, they can begin to frame these programs as, well, that's not that commentary program is really about entertaining the audience. It's not really about news. That's our whole purpose. This is just entertainment. Like, oh, I was just kidding. That kind of model creates a kind of, you know, upending of the standard news model within the system. And suddenly there's these old, you know, news outlets that are trying to stick with the program, which is fact-based, integrity-based news. And there's this upstart that says, that's boring. You know, some of the most integrity-based news based on the system that I have now is the stuff you would expect. It's like NPR, it's PBS. And I remember watching PBS back in the day, and PBS, while it was the news, now I know because I've done the research, with the most integrity, it was also a little bit more boring than the other news. It was just, they told it straight. They didn't tell it with a lot of emotion or entertainment. And Fox was always the most exciting news. It was the funnest. It was the most, you know, it got your blood pumping. And I think those models begin to evolve, and pretty soon you see why, you know, we have this problem with rabbit holes, right? It's a problem of fantasy versus reality. It's a problem of entertainment and emotion versus sort of thought and fact and just, you know, just the facts, ma'am.
Okay, we have our first caller, Bert in Boulder. Hello. Bert.
I think, first of all, am I on?
Yes, you are. We can hear you.
Oh, good. I'd like to, first of all, thank you and both of your guests. And I'd like to leave you with a kind of open question about how we used to have a solution for these problems that worked pretty well. I'm old enough to remember when we had far less corporatization / capitalization of our media, including especially newspapers. And then the other big change that happened was when we eliminated in the early 90s the Fairness in Media and Equal Time clauses. And I'm hoping that one or both of your guests would care to comment on those two things to set us up for what's happened to our media. And I'll take any kind of comments off air. Thank you.
Thank you, Bert. Anyone care to?
Well, I would say this. I think Bert is exactly right with the corporatization of media. I think the model is not that the media became too political or that there's a right wing and a left. The initial problem was that profit became so central to the models of media that we had in this country that they began to drive everything else. And there is nothing more profitable than entertainment, as we know from the explosion of the, you know, the film industry, the video game industry, like anything you think, Harry Potter, the most popular book of all time. Entertainment is the driver of profit. And so I think that as, you know, news media in general is never, it may have even been a profit loser, but those major networks felt an obligation to the public to create and produce the news, even though it wasn't generating the income. And so the problem is that the models are now, that we have now, everyone is expected to generate income, and the more income, the better. And so these news models that we have, you know, they are competing in against models of fantasy entertainment that they just cannot keep up with. And so this corporatization of news is a part of the problem. And this is partly why when I do my research now with Media Glass and these rankings from 8F, you know, at the very top are the sort of nonprofit and not for profit outlets. They just don't have that level of competition baked into the system, so they don't have to, you know, spice up the news in a way that you know loses integrity but adds emotion.
Well, we do have another caller, but before I want to make sure that Bert's question was answered. Claire, explain to the listeners what the Fairness Doctrine was.
The Fairness Doctrine, I'd have to... I don't want to spread misinformation. So,
but I threw that out because I'm like, I think it was overturned before you were born. How about you, Dr. Ellis?
Boy, this goes back. This is actually back before I started researching media itself. We had all kinds of things in place that were trying to make sure that we had integrity baked into the system of news media. And I mean, again, all I what it makes me think of as I jump between things like the economic realm and the realm of information and the realm of politics is how the political debates in this country used to be run by the League of Women Voters. And so what we have is a somewhat similar situation. They used to be run by this sort of nonprofit, sort of unbiased kind of arbiter. And then pretty soon after a while, they thought, well, you know, why don't we just take it over as political parties? And then the political parties themselves, we had the sort of like foxes guarding the hen house model in which they decided that they were going to take over the debates and put them on. And then you started to see the decline of both the questions asked in the debates and how canned the answers were. And now people see the debates for what, in some ways, what they've evolved into, political debates, which is, you know, these just extended advertisements for the candidates. You don't get any real information in these debates because no real questions are asked or answered. And, you know, this same model has been propagating across the economic sphere, across the information sphere, and across the political sphere in this country. And that's part of why we're losing these things that we find so fundamental.
Okay, we have another caller on the line. Jim in Boulder, good morning.
Hi. Part of the thing is that corporations and governments are sponsoring sanitized news, sort of like you're saying, entertaining stories, and they test them with focus groups. So there's books like Naomi Oreskes' Merchants of Doubt and a couple other ones that talk about the particular campaigns of creating like fake science that says that there is no ozone hole and tobacco doesn't cause cancer and global warming is not happening. So it's this whole anti-science thing, and it's being financed by oil companies, tobacco companies, and the military. The U.S. military has people who are paid to spread propaganda, and it used to be illegal for them to do it within the U.S., but I think it's legal for them to do it now. And the New York Times goes right along with it. I mean, the weapons of mass destruction are not releasing the story about how Bush was tapping everyone's phone and emails during the election when it was Kerry versus Bush in 2004. Anyway, it's not just sort of greenwashing. It's like here you have this great local radio station and some other ones around the country trying to do good things, but on the other side you have the oil companies with hundreds of billions of dollars and the U.S. military with trillions of dollars all putting out stories that they've tested with little focus groups like, does this have a beautiful little child, or does this have a grandmother, or is this something that makes you think about sex, or whatever. They find some way to get you to believe something or to be distracted while they continue doing what's most profitable. So I want to hear a little bit more about what you think we can do, but in part I think we need to cut back on the huge apparatus that's being used against us.
Okay, thank you, Jim. And, you know, I would like to just add to that that I think that what helps us most, you mentioned this, you know, local radio station, what helps us most here at KGNU is actually being able to have financial independence and have that financial independence be the accountability to the listener themselves. Is it completely fail safe? Not exactly, because I mean, I always have people pressuring me to put a certain spin on things, and I just rely on my own ethical and moral compass and just the groundwork and the foundation of always going back to provable fact, right? But it really, really is crucial. I mean, more than left and right and whatever is, what are the moneyed interests involved in something? And I think that, you know, I've been in independent media for more than 20 years, and that really has been the key. So when we do these fund drives, it's not just, you know, you are the you and KGNU or whatever kind of catchphrase that you may think you're being, you know, fed. It really is where the rubber meets the road. It really does make the crucial difference in being able portray events in what we think are a truthful way, and having to have our kind of hand led according to whether or not this will anger a corporate sponsor or not. We don't have to worry about that. You know, you may hear underwriting on KGNU. They're all like local businesses or organizations. I feel that the process here and the finances are very protective of our editorial freedom. So I just wanted to add that just because it's so, so crucial. And any comments in reaction to the caller before I get to the next call?
Yeah, I've got a circle I'm going to go in, but it's going to land, I promise. that was making me think a lot about, you know, it's not just like TV news media, and it's not just like social media platform companies. It's like they're like a lot of these different companies, like in these different like sectors, entertainment sectors and news and information sectors, they're all like concentrated into sort of like monopolies, right? I think one example that I can bring back to media literacy is something that's been happening with like libraries. I do a lot of research on libraries for for my grad school work. But one of the things I've been looking at is the case with the Internet Archive. Are you either of you familiar with this?
Can we talk about that like after this next call? Because I want to dig into that.
Okay.
So was there something else in the circle that you wanted to like go around before we... That particular case, let's dedicate a good chunk of time to
okay,
that.
Okay. No, I mean, I was just saying that, you know, I think that, we need to be thinking about who owns the media and
exactly.
The big corporate ownership.
Well, indeed.
And we also, I think, and this came from my corporate research, we also need to think about our own role. Because attention has now been monetized. So YouTubers that make money are the ones who get the most clicks and the most attention. And so you can see that monetization. But also, you know, when I was doing this research with corporations, I was starting to understand that fundamental driver that is our dollars on any given day and what kind of world it creates. And is it worth spending an extra 10 cents on the bananas or an extra 50 cents on, you know, the toothpaste to drive that money towards those good companies? And I started realizing, you know, we don't think about that responsibility usually on a daily basis. We're too busy. Like, I just need a more toothpaste, or I just need to go to the supermarket to get the week's groceries. But, you know, I circle back to things like public radio and how important that is as a kind of practice of democracy, that, you know, these public radio and community radio stations give us all of this kind of wonderful information and inform us and educate us, et cetera. And it's so important for us to close that loop as individuals, to take that responsibility to then help those institutions thrive. It really is practicing democracy, just like we should vote every, you know, at least every 4 years, if not every 2 years, if not more often than that, depending on local elections. You know, we need to practice this idea of engaging and understanding how valuable that engagement is, whether it's public radio or, you know, other forms of media, or it's, you know, going to the supermarket.
Yeah, absolutely. And just one quick thing before we go to, I see you, Jeff. I see you waiting. Jeff on the phone, not Uncle Jeff here in the studio. No, one thing that I wanted to add to that circularity as well is also, you know, it doesn't always have to be money. Bring your expertise as well. Money absolutely helps, but, you know, I believe a crucial service that KGNU and other community radio stations provide is training the next generation of people. So, you know, you had Christian in here giving his perspective. You see, you know, Kiara over in the other production studio having these kinds of training programs so that the next generation of media makers have this solid foundation is so absolutely crucial. But with that, I'm going to go to Jeff in Boulder, who has been patiently waiting on the line. Good morning, Jeff.
Hi. I just wanted to thank the commentator for the explanation of the Simpsons. I'd never watched it. And sort of along that line, I have a very a very conservative friend. Well, I had one anyway, a very conservative friend. He was a childhood friend and a large corporate chief executive officer. And I was invited to his home, and they watched, this was in California, I think in 2011 maybe, or, yeah, anyway, but they watched not The Simpsons, but they watched South Park.
Sure.
And then they gave me the explanation of, he and his wife gave me the explanation of the, that the writers were from here in the Front Range and so forth and so on, because I'm a writer, and so they kind of wanted to school me on the, you know, the, that entertainment. But I didn't really understand the kind of the significance of that sort of repartee. And the last thing I wanted to share was that Stephen King came here to Boulder, I think it was in 2013, and I was reading about it somehow in the Daily Camera, and he was up at Chautauqua, and he said, the thing about this job is people go to psychiatrists and pay them $60, $70 an hour. Obviously, it's way more than that now. $60, $70 an hour to tell them all their screwed up fantasies. And I write mine down, and people pay me, Stephen King told a capacity crowd at Boulder Chautauqua Auditorium. That's how I roll. Anyway, I just wanted to say that I think that encapsulates a bit of what we're talking about here, that there's such a, you know, here's one of the most highly paid writers in the world, and he is, you know, has this enormous platform, and he is so psychologically unsophisticated, and this is an incredibly bright man. He is so psychologically unsophisticated that he really has no conception about what a therapy session might look like or an analytical session might be like. He is so puerile in that respect. And I see that that kind of goes back to my childhood friend, which I had to let go of. You know, that he sort of reflects that same mentality. Obviously, they're on very different spectrums, politically speaking. But that sort of represents the kind of sort of consciousness that we're dealing with here. And I just want to say lastly that letting go of my friend, he was a childhood friend, and the grief that goes with that, even though, I mean, I just couldn't go along anymore, you know, with my friendship with him. But, I mean, I just couldn't, you know, but the grief that's gone along with that and the letting go of this person that I loved, that, you know, that we were friends, you know, kids. I mean, we shared, you know, incredible amount of youth together. So that's one of the tragedies of all this misinformation or, God, it's so awful. Anyway, I had to say that, and I apologize for rambling on.
I agree wholeheartedly, Jeff. I think this is one of the tragedies that that we're currently experiencing with media, is that relationships are often broken and ended over these media disputes about how we get our information and where we get it. And this is part of the reason, you know, this project originally emerged from my students, as I mentioned before, but it became a project to try and understand how can we stop this cycle of breaking all those relationships. Is there a way to bridge that divide? And I'm not 100% sure yet, but I think we're starting to make progress. And that's part of the reason why in this version of Media Glass, and in, I think I put the charts here in the front of the Better World Shopping Guide as well, that there's a chart for the left, the right, and the center. And, you know, some people can agree on the center, some people cannot, but there, if somebody in your family is far on the right or far on the left, I think it is possible to move them up in their sort of media nutrition diet to say, I'm not going to argue with you about politics because we're never going to see eye to eye, but I can help you, you know, move up the scale and get to better sources of information that still align with wherever you're at. And after maybe the two of you both move up enough, I think that there are more commonalities, because the farther down the spectrum you go on whatever end you are politically, the more likely you are to just have absolutely no common ground.
Well, we are in the final 5 minutes of our program. So if you'd like to get in line, get in a comment before we go, now would be the time to call. Our guests today are Dr. Ellis Jones. He received his doctoral degree in sociology from the University of Colorado Boulder. And we also have Claire Woodcock in studio with us. She is a graduate student in media studies. And we, you had mentioned, I do see that we have one call on the line, but not quite ready yet. So I want to take this opportunity to talk about libraries, the importance of the Internet Archive. What is going on there?
Yeah, briefly. Yeah, absolutely, for sure. So in 2020, like right when schools and libraries closed, the Internet Archive did something that was a little questionable. They let 1.4 million books that always had had like lending limits on them, just kind of like you would with a physical book, but they had it with a digital book. They let go of all of the lending limits. So there were 1.4 million books, most of them out of print or not, like haven't been like made into ebooks by publishers. Those were made available, and some corporate publishers got mad about it. So they ended up suing the Internet Archive. This massive like open library was available for 2.5 months, I think. And now they're being sued. And the state of like the future of the Internet Archive is at stake. And it's only at stake over 127 books that are in copyright. And these are popular books. They're like popular fiction and nonfiction pieces. You've got your James Pattersons, you've got your Bill Brysons in there. But I mean, like they're being sued right now. And one of the things that people are worried about is like, it's kind of a class issue. It's a classist thing in some ways, because like, I think that like libraries are meant to be places where you don't have to spend money. Like they're one of the places left where like there's not this corporate control, but actually there is corporate control, because like corporate publishers, they're kind of gutting libraries right now.
Well, and I would also say that not just libraries, but libraries and public schools are basically the two pillars,
sure,
holding up a lot of our education system, and especially when it comes to investing in the future of education. So I'm really pretty alarmed about this Internet Archive situation, because when I, for example, for some people may know that I was an editor at FSRN for many years, Free Speech Radio News, which was a program that was carried here on KGNU for many, many years. When we went off the air and decided, what are we going to do with our audio archive? Well, KGNU adopted part of it. And also it's like, well, let's put it on archive.org, because that's where I felt the most, that's where I felt it was safest to remain in perpetuity,
mm-hmm.
Right? So it's alarming to me. And it's not just a class issue, but I was also based in Mexico. So when I would want to refer somebody to some books, there are some books that are out of print or that are unavailable in other countries, I would go to the Internet Archive to go get those. So it really is such a crucial institution. And to have that kind of in the crosshairs is it's frankly quite alarming to me.
Yeah, I think that just like thinking about like paywalls, the more that you put paywalls in front of reliable and verifiable news and information, I think that the more you have this divide, ultimately.
I have to say, you know, I have to admit there are only three places that I give money to on any regular basis. One is my local public radio station. Another is Wikipedia. And the third is the Internet Archive. I think is absolutely fundamental to the future of democracy in this country to have not just libraries, which I think should be, you know, funded tenfold to where they are right now, but to have things like the Internet Archive and Wikipedia, as well as local radio stations.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Ellis Jones and Claire Woodcock. Thank you so much for coming into the studio and answering questions today. Coming up next is Uncle Jeff with the MSA, and Alexis Kenyon, my colleague, just wrote me a note saying we will also be continuing this conversation online on our Facebook page. So if you want to join or just observe, visit KGNU's Facebook page. You're listening to KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins.